You're listening to After the Storm, where the healing begins on UK Health Radio. I'm Brian D. Smith, founder of Grief to Growth and a certified grief guide, life coach, and author. This part of my journey began after the passing of my 15-year-old daughter, Shayna. So I'm doing the work too. Each week, we explore the journey through grief, not just surviving loss, but discovering who you're becoming on the other side of it. This is where the healing begins. There's a simple reason why most meditation advice fails. It's because you've been told how to do it wrong. It tells you to stop thinking. Your mind is never going to stop thinking. Neither is mine. It never will, not while you're alive. Your mind is designed to think. Why would you want to try to get it to stop? So if you've ever tried to meditate, if you sat there for 5 minutes and you thought, I'm terrible at this. My head won't shut up. I want to tell you this. You were not doing it wrong. You were told the wrong thing. Well, today, I want to give you the right thing, and I want to tell you why it's so important. Welcome to After the Storm. For the last couple of weeks, you and I have lived inside of four letters, GEMS: gratitude, exercise and sleep, mindfulness, and self-care. These are the four practices that carried me through the worst of it after my daughter Shayna passed away. These are the things that developed over years, and I've talked in great detail about what they are, how we can get started doing them, and why they're so important. But today, I want to slow down on one of them. I want to slow down on the M, mindfulness or meditation. I actually am giving it its own hour on purpose because mindfulness does something that the other three really can't. It lets you catch your own mind in the act. It's the whole thing that this reframing turns on. And reframing is basically what we're doing here. We're taking something that is a tragedy, and we see only as a tragedy, and we see the negative, and we're trying to turn it into something positive. We're trying to see the positive within it. That's the reframing. And it's the mindfulness that allows us to do the reframing, the ability to catch ourselves when we're going into that negative space that we don't want to be in, and to bring ourselves back to reality or back to a more positive space. This is the practice that lets you step back from the storm instead of getting swept up into it. There's a voice in your head. Now, I understand, I guess there are some exceptions. I've heard of people that don't have an internal dialogue. Frankly, I don't even understand how that's possible. It's very, very rare condition. But for most of us, for 99.995% of us, we have a voice in our head. You know the voice I'm talking about. I don't mean anything mystical. I'm not talking about voices of spirits or demons or angels or anything like that. I mean that running commentary going on right now, even underneath my words, that voice is talking to you. It's the voice that narrates your day. It's the one that woke up with you this morning and started in before your feet even hit the floor. In grief, that voice gets louder. And frankly, it gets meaner. It says you should be further along by now. It says everybody else is handling this better than you are. It says if only you had done something different, they'd still be here. It says you should have said this to them while they were still here. It says you should never have said that to them. It's that voice that's just constantly berating you and telling you that you're not doing things right. Now, here's the first thing I want you to notice. You can hear that voice. As I'm talking about it, you're probably recognizing the voice I'm talking about. If you can hear that voice, then it isn't you. You are the one listening to it. That small gap between you and the voice is where every bit of today's work happens. And what we're going to do today is we're going to work on finding that gap, expanding that gap, and making a conscious decision within that gap. So for me, when Shayna passed away, I thought about the fact that maybe I should have taken her to different doctors. Maybe I should have not had her on some of the medications that she was on. I've talked to so many people who have had children pass away, and they'll say, if only I'd been more strict on them, then maybe they'd still be here. But also maybe if I had been less strict on them, maybe they'd still be here. But most people never even notice that this voice is happening. They don't think of this voice as something different from them. They think the voice is them. We think we are our thoughts a lot of times. We have a thought and we think we are the thought. And we also think our thoughts are not within our control. They just come and they just pop into our head. But I want to tell you that neither one of those things are true. That voice that you're listening to is not you. It's not the best part of you. It's not the highest part of you. It's not the most advanced part of you. And you do have some control over your thoughts. You can choose which thoughts you want to dwell on, which thoughts you want to go down the rabbit hole with, which thoughts that you ruminate on that come up over and over and over again. The thing I really want you to get is I can respond to this voice in any way that I decide I want to. Who is it who's talking? Well, over the years, I found two maps, I'm going to call them, or two models that really help me make sense of these voices that we have that we're talking about. Neither one of these is the truth with a capital T. They're maps. They're models. But a good map gets you where you want to go. So the first one comes from Shehzad Shamin. And it's a body of work called Positive Intelligence. Shehzad, who I actually took Positive Intelligence with, says the voice isn't one voice. It's a committee. And he calls this committee saboteurs. There's a ringleader in this committee that he calls the judge. The judge is a part of you that criticizes you, criticizes other people, criticizes your circumstance. The judge never runs out of material. And the travels with a gang of saboteurs that are kind of co-conspirators, if you want to call it that. There's a controller who has to have everything gripped tight, got to be in charge of everything and make sure everything is right. There's the pleaser who earns love by making their own needs disappear. That's a part of you that says yes when you don't want to say yes. There's the hyperachiever who's only as good as the last thing they got done. Then there's the victim who pulls back into the hurt. Those are just a few of the saboteurs, but you probably recognize some of these things within yourself. The saboteurs will tell you that they're really important. That's how you got to where you are, because you've been so hypervigilant, because you've been a hyperachiever, because you're always in control, because you have to be. These voices tell you that they're important and you think they're important, but you're going to realize they're not making you happy. Now, again, you may recognize a couple of these. I recognize all of them on a bad day. And as much work as I've done, yes, the voices are still there. They're not as loud as they used to be, but they're still there. The second map comes from a psychologist named Richard Schwartz. And the model is called Internal Family Systems, which I found out about after I'd taken Positive Intelligence. You might have heard it referred to as IFS. Schwartz noticed a pattern after years of listening to people. When you say things like, part of me wants to get out of bed, and part of me just wants to pull the covers back over my head. He says you're not just talking in metaphor. You actually have parts. The mind is less like one single self and more like a family, thus internal family systems. Now, I don't believe either one of these models or maps are literal, but they're really good ways of understanding ourselves. And here's the piece that changed how I do the work that I do. In Schwartz's map, and I think, frankly, in Positive Intelligence to maybe a lesser extent, even your worst behaving parts are trying to protect you. These parts are not our enemy. They are not here to tear us down. They're not here to make us miserable. They're here to protect us. The part that goes numb in front of the television, the part that buries itself in work so it doesn't have to feel, the part even that snaps at the people you love the most. None of them are your enemy. Every one of them is a bodyguard that learned his job during something painful and never got the memo that the danger passed. So they developed to protect you as you were going through things in your childhood or things in your past, and they just stuck around longer than they needed to. And I want you to think of them maybe even, especially internal family systems, as almost little children, as the parts of you that aren't as mature as you are. And they're there to help you, and they're scared because they think there's danger. And you are the adult in the room at this point, and you're going to work with them as opposed to try to fight them. So these parts, they're managers basically that keep you functional. They're firefighters you can think of that douse pain, okay? That get rid of that pain for you. They protect you by lashing out. But think of them again as young, wounded parts. If you're a practical type person like I am and you stuck with me this far, you're probably already asking the obvious question. All right, fine. I've got a judge and I've got a committee of bodyguards. Why don't I just tell them to knock it off? just stop. Go away. Well, here's the thing. You probably already tried, but it doesn't work. When one of these parts is running hot, when you're in the middle of the storm, when you're in the middle of a grief burst, if you're stressed and you're anxious, when that judge wakes you up at 3 o'clock in the morning and has the microphone, you can't reason with it. You can't argue your way out of it. And there's a reason. In that moment, in that time of stress, in that time of pain, there's no daylight between you and the part. You're not just watching the judge. You've become the judge. IFS has a word for that. They say you're blended. It's when you cannot separate yourself from the part or from the saboteur. You can't get distance from something that you're fused with. And willpower doesn't make the distance. It just frankly gives the part something to push against. If you try to fight these parts, if you try to wrestle them, if you try to push against them, it's just not going to work. And again, that's not really what we want to do anyway. The game changes. The goal was never to win the argument. The goal is frankly to get a little bit of space. And you can't manufacture that space in the middle of the storm if you've never practiced it in calm water. That's what mindfulness and meditation is about. It's practicing during the times when you're not going through this. The practice has a name, and again, it's mindfulness. Mindfulness has been used so much that it's starting to mean nothing. And I know it means different things to different people. I'm not here to debate whether anybody's right or wrong. So let's define it here so we can agree going forward with the plainest definition I know of when I say mindfulness. Mindfulness is very simple. It's just noticing what's happening while it's happening without jumping in. That's really it. It's just noticing the thought without becoming a thought. It's noticing the feeling without drowning in the feeling. It's watching the judge stand up to speak and not handing him the microphone. So mindfulness is simply the act of noticing what's happening while it's happening. It's just that simple. It's not stopping your mind. It's not controlling your mind. It's observing. There's a line that's often credited to Viktor Frankl. Between stimulus and response, there's a space. And in that space is our freedom. Now, I can't swear that Frankl said it in those exact words, but whoever said it, if they said those words, they were right. That space is the whole thing. That's it. It's the space. And mindfulness is how you make that space wider. Mindfulness is how you make space to take control over your actions. There are many doors into this room of mindfulness. You can observe the breath, taking a walk where you actually just feel your feet hit the ground, doing a body scan on a phone app, just scanning how you're feeling in each part of your body, going from the top of your head down to your toes, very deliberately and slowly. Prayer is a way of mindfulness, if that's your thing. Sitting quietly with a single word. Now, you'll notice these things are not all identical. And yeah, I do have a favorite that I'm about to teach you. But here's the thing. The best practice in the world is the one you're going to come back to tomorrow. A better technique that you quit is worse than a simple one that you keep. I cannot tell you how many people I've talked to that say they fail at mindfulness, so they give up. They say, you just don't understand. I can't do it. I can't stop my mind. Well, we've already said the goal is not to stop your mind. And they may have said, well, I can't sit just quietly for 5 minutes. that doesn't have to be the way you do it, or 5 minutes or 15 minutes or whatever it happens to be. If you say you can't meditate or you can't practice mindfulness, I would challenge you and say, you just haven't found the right technique yet. There are so many ways. I use an app called Insight Timer, and you can do silent meditation. You can listen to ambient sounds. You can listen to music. You can do guided meditations. That's just within one app. Now, for me, mindfulness, I started practicing back when I was studying Buddhism many, many years ago. But it really started to catch on for me when I started on my morning walks. I do 6 miles almost every day, mainly before the world wakes up. And frankly, I wasn't calling it meditation, but somewhere when I was out there doing my walks, I learned to let a thought arrive and let it leave without chasing after it. And that's the muscle. And you can start building it anywhere. And when I call it a muscle, I really mean it like a muscle. You think about when we go to the gym and we use resistance to build our muscles. So you're going to have a stimulus, and you're going to have a feeling. You're going to want to go to a response. But again, we're building that gap. And then the muscle is coming back to, I'm going to make a choice instead of reacting. And you can start building this anywhere. You can do it while you're doing the dishes. You can do it while you're brushing your teeth. You can start to practice mindfulness anywhere, just noticing what's happening. The technique that is my favorite, that I've stuck with for now several years.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
The station that makes you feel good.
That works the best for me. It's called Turning Within. And it was developed by a man named Kelvin Chen, who is a friend of mine, a mentor of mine. It's worth sitting with Kelvin's story for a minute because it tells you something about the technique itself. Kelvin learned to meditate at the age of 19. He learned Transcendental Meditation, TM. And he didn't just learn it. In the early 70s, he studied directly with the man who brought it to the West, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. He became one of the movement's international teachers for about a decade. And Kelvin was very young at the time. And he learned meditation, frankly, because he had anxiety. He taught meditation at West Point. He taught to soldiers on the DMZ in Korea. He was even a test subject in some of the very first medical studies of meditation ever run in this country by a Harvard cardiologist named Herbert Benson. So Kelvin has been immersed in this for a long, long time, I guess over 50 years. But then Kelvin walked away from the branded version of it, Transcendental Meditation, for whatever reasons. I think there's some things about it that he didn't particularly agree with. But Kelvin's a very practical person. One of the things I love about working with Kelvin is he breaks things down. He makes them very logical. He makes them very simple. So when Kelvin walked away from TM, he kept what worked and he let the rest go. He stripped off all the ceremony, the cost, the cultural trappings, all of it, until he boiled it down to its essence. And what was left was something anyone can learn in a few sessions. And then you can practice for free for the rest of your life. The thing about turning within is if there's a trap, if there's a trick to it, it's that it's too simple. I had been studying meditation for a while. When I started taking it from Kelvin, it's just interesting, the questions that I would ask, and I kind of laugh and smile about it now, and the questions other people would ask. It's like, you know, is this right? Is this right? Am I doing this right? And Kelvin was just kind of like, basically, you know, let it go. And there's one more thing about Kelvin, and that's why he sits so close to the heart of this show. Kelvin's mother passed when he was still young. And that loss pointed him toward the same questions you and I sit here with every week. Now, Kelvin went on to write a book called Overcoming the Fear of Death. If you do have a fear of death, I highly recommend that book. But the man who simplified this meditation did it in part as someone who was actually in grief. And that's one of the things that Kelvin and I have in common. I think one of the reasons why we resonate so much with each other. So even though he is a very, very practiced meditator, has extensive knowledge of the afterlife from firsthand experience as well as studying, he is deeply human in his approach to things. I'm not going to teach you the technique here. I don't have the expertise or the time to do it, but I do want to give you kind of an outline of why I like turning within and why I think it's really great for everybody to take a look at. Because it's very simple. And I can give it to you pretty plainly today. As I said, there's some fine tuning you need to do. I recommend you look up Kelvin and learn more about it. A few sessions with Kelvin or any good teacher will be any description I can give you here in this monologue. So again, I don't want you to think, well, I listen to this, I can go off and do this, I don't need anything else. I forget how many sessions it is for Kelvin to teach Turning Within. He allows you to come back over and over again for refreshers, but it's worth doing with him. So, but basically you sit down somewhere comfortable. You don't have to be uncomfortable. Some meditation techniques tell you have to sit on the floor. Your back's got to be straight and rigid. You've got to cross your legs into forms that you can't get into when you're a certain age. Not true at all. You can sit somewhere comfortable, a chair. I sometimes meditate on a chair. I sometimes meditate on a cushion. But I sometimes meditate lying in my bed, just however I feel. The first rule is you want to be comfortable. You don't have to put your body through torture. You close your eyes and you use a sound. Now, when you take Turning Within meditation with Kelvin, he'll give you a sound. Now, it's called a sound because it's a word in terms of, it sounds like a word that you think of, but you think this word in your mind, and it doesn't have meaning. That's the important thing. It's not something that has meaning. It's just a sound. Some people call it a mantra. Kelvin, again, to try to strip away the cultural aspects of it, calls it a sound, which is what it is. You repeat this, not out loud. It's not forced. You're not forcing it on yourself. You just introduce it and say it very gently, the way you set a leaf down on the surface of a pond. And as your mind starts to drift, which it's going to do, and you notice it's drifting, you gently return to the sound. You're not correcting yourself. You're not forcefully slamming back to the sound. You're just noticing your mind drifting, and you come back to the sound. And this is a part that people get wrong. You let your mind do whatever it does. You let your mind be your mind. Thoughts are going to come. Okay, that's fine. Thoughts are not the enemy. When you catch yourself planning dinner or replaying an argument that you had, you don't scold yourself. You don't beat up on yourself. And you're not starting over. You just easily come back to the sound. And then when you drift again, because you will, you come back to the sound again. And here's the thing people get wrong about meditation. It's not a successful meditation, air quotes, because you stayed on the sound and never drifted away. The drifting away and the coming back, that's the practice. It's not the practice failing. It is actually the practice. It's that returning. And you can't return if you haven't drifted away. So Kelvin will give you a couple of rules, and I love them for their honesty and their simplicity. Rule number one is be comfortable. Rule number two is no forcing. And that's the part that I really struggle with. And that's the part a lot of people struggle with. There is no forcing in this. That's the whole posture. It's 20 minutes twice a day is what he suggests. That's the classic dose. That's what I try to do. I try to do it mid-morning and then sometime in the mid-afternoon. Now, if twice a day sounds like a fantasy in your life right now, then you could do it once a day. If 20 minutes is too much, do it 10. I love Kelvin's analogy. It's like if you're going swimming or you get in a pool, you get wet. And when you meditate, if you can't do it for 20 minutes, if you can do it for any amount of time, at least you got wet. The perfect version that you never do loses every time to the smaller version you can actually keep. So find something that works for you in your life and work on that. I was talking with a client the other day about practicing mindfulness. And what I don't want to do is tell someone, okay, here's the thing. You're going to practice 20 minutes twice a day, because what will happen inevitably is you might do it for a couple of days, and then you might do 20 minutes in the morning a few days, and then, you know, that gets cut short. And next thing, because you're not doing 20 minutes twice a day, you stop doing everything. We don't want to do that. So start with what works for you, and if you can expand it, fine. Frankly, I don't get 20 minutes twice a day on probably most days. It's usually once a day. But I want to tell you what to expect so that you don't quit on day two, because you're going to feel like you're failing. You're going to feel like nothing is happening. You're going to feel like, well, my mind's just doing what my mind does the way it's always done. That's fine. It's probably not going to feel like bliss. A lot of times what we do is when we come out of a meditation session is we judge it. How did I feel? How focused was I? Do I feel blessed? Did I go someplace? Did I have some experience? And you're going to have some sessions that are going to feel deep and still. And you're going to have other sessions that are going to feel like 20 minutes of grocery lists and old regrets. Both are fine. You don't grade a session by how peaceful it felt. Some of the sessions doing the most work for you underneath are the ones that felt the busiest. And Kelvin will tell you this. You can't really judge, because you're processing stuff that's underneath, stuff that's subconscious, and it comes up, and sometimes it's going to come up maybe as busyness. So it's not for you from a conscious level to judge how your session went. And the thing about meditation is the results aren't really showing up during those 20 minutes. We're not trying to become the world's best meditator to have 20 minutes of bliss while we're on the cushion or in the chair. The results are not showing up during those 20 minutes. They show up at 4 in the afternoon, when the thing that would have wrecked your whole day a month ago comes and goes, and you notice you had that half second of choice that you didn't used to have. That's the results. That's what we're looking for. So it's not the results that are actually on the cushion. It's what we do when we're off the cushion that we're doing this for. And you'll start to notice it with, again, a little bit more calm, not being as reactive to things that happen, being able to make a choice as to how you respond. I differentiate between reacting and responding this way. Reacting is when there's a stimulus and a reflex, and there's nothing in between it. Something happens, and you have a reaction. When you respond, there's a stimulus, there's a pause, a break, a gap, and then you choose your action. You choose a response. That's the difference to me between reacting and responding. So I'm giving you all this, and I'm an engineer by training, as I keep bringing up over and over again, because I've told you I'm not going to ask you to believe anything that you're listening to my program without me giving you some reason to believe it. So before any of this was spiritual for me, it had to make sense. And frankly, I started meditating, I think, for the same reasons that Kelvin did. I had a lot of anxiety when I was younger. I felt like I was just an anxious person. Let me tell you what the research actually says. The strongest evidence is for anxiety and for low mood or depression. A large review in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Internal Medicine Journal pulled dozens of trials and found that meditation programs produce a real, moderate drop in anxiety and depression. It's not a miracle cure, but moderate and real is roughly on par with a lot of other frontline treatments. And given that it doesn't cost you anything and it has no side effects, then why not try it? So for me, I've done other things. I've went to counseling. I did try some medications, but mindfulness is something that, again, doesn't cost me and it has no side effects and it's effective. Clinical trial in that same journal took adults with an average age in their mid-60s who were sleeping badly and taught half of them mindfulness. The meditators slept better, and they did better than a second group who got sensible standard sleep hygiene advice. So I'm going to repeat that so it's very clear. A lot of times when we're in grief, we have difficulty sleeping. And sometimes as we get older, we have difficulty sleeping. So these are people in their mid-60s who were sleeping badly, and they were taught mindfulness, and the meditators slept better. And then there was a second group who got sensible, just a standard sleep hygiene advice. You know, have your room cool. Don't be on your phone before you go to sleep. Have your room quiet, etc. The meditation beat the sleep tips also. No reason why you can't do both. Do the standard sleep hygiene. Highly recommend it. Practice it myself. But also meditation can help us sleep better. And when we're in grief, our energy is being drained in a lot of senses, and sleep becomes so much more important than it is even when we're not in grief. It's a time to rest. It's a time to reset. Frankly, it's a time to escape. So that sleep, being able to sleep better, huge benefit of meditation. And it goes deeper than mood and sleep.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
We talked in an earlier episode about how grief affects the body physically, how it can increase inflammation, how it can increase your blood pressure, you can harden your digestion. There's a growing pile of evidence showing that regular meditation quiets the body's inflammation machinery. It turns down some of the genetic switches that drive chronic inflammation. The same low-grade fire that grief stokes in the body, which you and I talked about a few weeks back. This research is younger, So for today's purposes, I'm going to call it promising rather than proven, but it points in the same direction as everything else. And it makes sense that we're reducing our stress levels, reducing our cortisol, reducing our adrenaline. So all those things make sense that it would have this effect. And this goes all the way back to Kelvin's cardiologist, Herbert Benson, who I mentioned earlier. 50 years ago, Benson showed that this kind of practice sets off a measurable state, heart rate down, blood pressure down, the whole stress response loosening its grip. He called it the relaxation response. Your nervous system has a brake, and this is how you find that brake pedal, by practicing mindfulness, by practicing meditation. So again, I would say to you, why wouldn't you try this? All it's going to cost you is some time. The potential benefits are huge. As we've talked about, there's a wide range of benefits, including allowing you to handle everything else in your life a little bit better as you're going through the normal stresses and strains of life. I want to connect this straight to grief, as I've done a little bit as we've been going through this, because this is the personal part for me. A grieving nervous system is a body that's stuck on high alert. Something huge went wrong. Your system knows it, and it stays braced, waiting for the next blow. That's why you can't sleep. That's why small things level you. That's why you're tired in a way that rest really doesn't fix. You feel like everything goes wrong. Things are just going to keep going wrong. Everything is wrong. You're not going to think your way out of it. This is happening below the level of thinking. You've got to find that gap that we talked about earlier, that gap between having a thought and how you react to it, but also you've got to find a way to identify the parts of you that are telling you that everything is wrong, that hypercritical part of you that says everything is wrong, the judge that says everything is wrong, the members of the family, internal family systems, that's telling you everything is wrong. You've got to find a way to quiet those voices. What 20 quiet minutes gives an overwhelmed system is a couple of stretches in the day where you're not bracing, where you get to touch that brake pedal on your nervous system. You're not trying to feel blissful. You're not bypassing your grief, and you're not rushing it along. You're giving your body a short rest from the red alert twice a day. An arrested nervous system has a wider gap, more room between the wave and the way you answer it. Again, 20 minutes, I know, is a lot. I was working with a client the other day who works from home and has a very busy schedule. What if instead of you do 20 minutes twice a day, what if you could do 5 minutes once an hour during your workday? What if you just take 5 minutes, you could set a timer, and once an hour for 5 minutes, you're going to close your eyes and just do this technique for a few minutes. You can get, there's something called a Pomodoro timer, and you can buy them on Amazon, and you can set that so it breaks up your workday. So you work for a few minutes and you practice some sort of mindfulness. That's a very small way to get started. Preferably, you can do 20 minutes once or twice a day, but if you can't, practice that. And you could tie it to other habits that you do. Let's say that you take a break at 10 o'clock in the morning or whatever it is during your workday. You could practice it then. Maybe before you go to lunch or after you get back for lunch, you could practice then. And before, sometime in that mid-afternoon. So find ways that work for you and maybe tie it to something else that you're normally going to do and make it a regular thing. Hopefully you understand this is why mindfulness sits right at the center of reframing that this whole show is all about. You can't see your grief differently while you're still drowning in it. You have to get some separation. You have to be able to pull back a little bit. You have to get your head above water first, even for a few seconds. And meditation is how you learn to find the surface. Meditation is how you get that little bit of a break, how you can get that little bit of a gap to do the other things that we're talking about. Let me clear four excuses out of your way before they get to you, because they get to pretty much everybody. The first is, I don't have time. Now, people will say this, and there's an old joke. It says, if you don't have time to meditate for half an hour, meditate for an hour. You do have 20 minutes. We all spend time longer than that scrolling, and you know it. This is you choosing you. And we're never going to find time, as I've mentioned before. There's only so much time in the day. We all have the same amount of time in the day. We have to make time. We're always doing something. So this is replacing something you'd be doing with something else. And it might be scrolling on your phone. It might be sleeping. Maybe you get up 20 minutes earlier. Or maybe in the evening, before you go to bed, you say, I'm going to go upstairs 20 minutes earlier and then practice my mindfulness before I go to sleep. You can make the time. The second excuse people have is, I can't clear my mind. Well, as we started off saying, the good news is you were never supposed to. So a busy mind is not failed meditation. Sometimes I have meditation sessions that just feel like I just can't get into it today. And I'm going to be really frank with you, like I always try to be. Sometimes I'll be practicing my 20-minute meditation and I'll be 15 minutes in. I'm like, I'm just going to go do something else. Because it's just one of the, sometimes I just can't settle into it. It's not a failure. It doesn't mean that you did it wrong. It's just that some days are kind of like that. And I'm not so wedded to it's got to be exactly 20 minutes that I won't say today's only going to be 10 or 15 minutes. A lot of times when it happens, though, I'll come back later in the day and try to do another session. So if you're a person that says, I can't clear my mind, let that go. You're not supposed to. Another thing people will say is, I fell asleep. And if I remember correctly, I think Kelvin said he fell asleep a lot during his early meditations. That's fine if you fall asleep. That means you were tired and your body took what it needed. This is not a crisis. This is not a problem. You know, maybe next time you sit up a little bit straighter, if you find that every time you lay down to meditate, you're falling asleep, then maybe you change things a little bit. But again, that's not a failure. And if you're going through grief and you're having trouble sleeping and you get some sleep instead of meditating, fine. That's not a problem. Now, here's the last one. I did it for a week and I felt nothing. Nothing changed. I'm just wasting my time. Now, this is the real one. This is the real one. This is a practice with a slow payoff. This is like investing a small amount of money into an account that you don't check. You don't feel the savings grow. You just find one ordinary day that you can handle something that you haven't handled before. And that's what I found for me when it comes to mindfulness meditation. It didn't make me feel blissful while I was doing it. I frankly still never had a blissful meditation, I haven't had like an out-of-body experience meditation where I saw angels or went somewhere. I have some meditations that are very, very peaceful and maybe blissful in a certain sense. But that's not the goal. And I didn't find that my blood pressure just dropped, so I don't need medication anymore. I still take blood pressure medication. I didn't get that kind of benefit from it. But the results are slow. And I have noticed that I do have more patience. I have noticed that I'm not as stressed in general. I've noticed I can make a switch. If I'm going down a road that I don't want to go down, I'm having thoughts that I don't want to have, I can catch it. I can identify the saboteur and I can say, okay, I'm going to let that go because that's my saboteur speaking. That's not my higher self speaking. That's not where I want to be. And that is a benefit that I can tie directly to my mindfulness practice. This has been years for me to get to this point. So give it some time. Here's all I'm asking. I'm not asking you to adopt a new lifestyle. I'm not saying go out and buy an altar and incense and a cushion. I have all those things. Frankly, I don't use them nearly as much as I used to. You don't have to buy anything. I do advise you to take Turning Within with Kelvin, but if you just try this little bit of mindfulness thing, it can't hurt. So try it once today. Find a chair. Sit down. Close your eyes. 20 minutes if you got them. 10 minutes if you don't. Let the thoughts come and gently come back. Maybe you choose a sound, a nonsensical word. It could be anything. Just something that doesn't really have a lot of meaning to you. So not something that's emotionally charged. That's really kind of the point. It's just kind of a touchstone. But you're going to come back to that gently. And just try it. It's not about emptying the mind. It's just about meeting yourself somewhere quieter than the storm. It's taking some time out of that for 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes. So next week, we're going to go one level down because you can sit and you can do everything right and the saboteur voices still won't quiet down. Maybe the judge just gets louder in the silence. Next week, we're going to talk about what to actually do with those parts, how to turn toward them, to get to know them, and start letting a few of them off duty. The bodyguards who've been on shift since the day your world broke open. Until then, be gentle with yourself. Do the 20 minutes. And remember what we always say here. You are planted, not buried. I'll see you next week. Thank you for spending this time with me on After the Storm. If today's conversation resonated with you, I'd love to continue the journey together. You can find more of my work at www.grieftogrowth.com. That's grief, G-R-I-E-F, the numeral 2, growth.com. Until next week, remember, after the storm is where the healing begins.